From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Is America drying up? Hello again, I'm Oren Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. After a year with almost no rain in Southern California, almost a million people have been forced from their homes in just 4 days. Across the country, dry weather's causing a slow-motion disaster, with Georgia, Alabama, and Florida forced to compete for the same dwindling water supply. It's also hotter and drier than usual in Minnesota, the Northeast, and the Mid-Atlantic. On To the Point, is it a spell of strange weather or long-term climate change? What about global warming? Will industry, agriculture, and residential development have to change to ward off future disaster? On Reporter's Notebook later on, it's the Red Sox and the Rockies in this year's World Series. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. California is tinder dry. The Southeast is facing a critical shortage of water. Winter is coming late to the Northeast and the Mid-Atlantic. On To the Point, is it just a spell of weird weather or long-term climate change? Will industry, agriculture, and residential development have to adapt to stave off future disasters? On Reporter's Notebook, Colorado's Miracle Team begins the World Series tonight. Are the Red Sox still lovable? We'll hear the latest baseball wisdom. First, this news update. Decreasing winds in Southern California are giving firefighters a chance to gain ground. Some residents are being allowed to go home or to see what's left of their homes. Others are still being evacuated. Damage estimates are of at least $1 billion in San Diego County alone. Tony Manolotos reports for the San Diego Union-Tribune. Tony, good to have you with us.
Hi, Warren. Good to be back on your show.
Some good news with the wind dying down a bit. What progress have the firefighters been able to make?
They're starting to feel a little bit better about the weather conditions. They don't have very, very much of these fires contained, only, you know, single digits when it comes to percent of containment. But they are hopeful that by this afternoon, the winds are going to give them a break.
5 dead so far, 45 hurt. That's really a very small number when you consider the number of people who have been directly, immediately affected by this.
Yes, we've sort of dodged a bullet when it comes to injuries and death. But there's 1,300 homes so far that have burned down. So there's a lot of devastation, and there's still a lot of uneasiness in the air.
The president has declared a disaster in 7 counties in Southern California. How much difference are federal resources going to make?
Well, at this point, I think people need supplies, food, water. Some people still need shelter. They said today they're going to start slowly letting some people back into their homes, but there's still a danger zone out there. Even though they expect the winds to die down this afternoon, that might not happen. So I'm not so sure federal aid is going to make a whole lot of difference. But people here are looking for, especially people who have been forced out of their homes, looking for any type of help they can get.
Tony Manolotos, again, reporting with the San Diego Union-Tribune. Up in Orange County, the fire authority chief, Chip Prather, there, has been saying if they'd had more air resources, they'd been able to control this fire. Is there some finger-pointing beginning?
There is a little bit of that, but we had air resources here. They were grounded, unfortunately. They couldn't get up in the air early on Sunday and Monday because of the high winds and all the and the low visibility because of all the ash. So there were helicopters and planes that were grounded.
Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger angry about people saying they didn't have enough resources. He said they had 90 aircraft, 6 that came from the federal government, but a lot of them couldn't fly because of the wind. So there's obviously 2 sides to this argument.
Yes, definitely. The problem they faced, part of the problem they faced is these fires were so intense because of the high winds. They couldn't get in front of these fires, so they needed to do airdrops. Well, they couldn't do airdrops because of the winds were too strong. So they really were kind of at the mercy of Mother Nature.
What about complaints that San Diego, particularly fiscally conservative and very Republican as it's always been, has left the city short of firefighters, and there's no fire chief for the county of San Diego, only for the city? Is there much talk about that?
You're starting to hear rumblings. Like you said earlier, there's some finger pointing starting to surface. As you know, San Diego is a fiscally conservative. It's a Navy town, really, at its core. A lot of Republicans here. Folks aren't real happy about new taxes here. But it's larger than that. San Diego has had fiscal problems for the last few years because they've run into a $1 billion pension deficit. So we are short firefighters. We are short fire stations. But the folks I've talked to, the fire experts I've talked to, said even with, 1,000 more firefighters, they just wouldn't have been able to get in front of these flames. They were just too intense, and the wind was just so strong.
We've only got a few seconds left, really, about a minute, but what's the most memorable story that you've covered in this past week?
That's an easy one. There was a rescue of four firefighters who were trying to rescue a father and his son. The father is the one individual who, of the five people who have died, there's only been one that died directly from the fire, and that was this man, unfortunately. His son, 15-year-old, is in a burn unit with these firefighters, and these four firefighters, heroic measures to get to the son and the dad, and then there was a helicopter who swooped in and pulled these four firefighters and this 15-year-old to safety. So that's really been the most remarkable story that I've come across.
All right. A lot of drama, obviously, with all that is going on in Southern California. And Tony Manolatos, thanks again for being with us.
Thanks, Warren, for having me.
Once more, a reporter with the San Diego Union Tribune. More to come in the next few days, of course. In a moment, is America drying up on To the Point?
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. California is not the only state where dry weather is causing severe problems. The National Climate Data Center has reported that 43% of the country is in a condition of moderate to extreme drought. California's wildfires and evacuations have dominated this week's news, but on the other side of the country, there is a kind of slow-motion disaster that has several states competing for a dwindling supply of water. Matt Kempner writes for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and Matt, good to have you on our program.
Good to be here.
Here we have the governor of Georgia asking the president for a disaster declaration, which would allow him to do certain things. The governor of Alabama is telling the president to please don't issue that disaster declaration. That would cause a disaster in Alabama. Tell us what's going on.
It's a messy situation. You wouldn't expect water to be such a contentious issue in a place like Metro Atlanta. We get three times as much precipitation, at least in normal years, than places like Los Angeles, and yet for years we've been in a water war with neighboring states in Florida and Alabama. What we're going through right now is a really extreme drought. They're expecting that our lake levels, the levels in Lake Lanier, our main water source for Metro Atlanta, will be down at historic lows. Streams are drying up, and they're talking about the possibility of having to put in emergency temporary barges and pumps to get the water out of the lake at much deeper levels.
So what about the city of Atlanta? I've seen a report that it might run out of water by the end of the year.
Well, it's possible. The state claims that it's possible within roughly 80 days or so, readily available water supplies will be exhausted. But in fact, there are, with these barges and temporary pumps, they could get water from deeper levels in lakes. So I don't think that there's any possibility at the moment that any thought that we'll actually run out of water. It'll just be a lot harder to get it, supposedly, according to the state. By the way, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and the state of Alabama disagree. They still think we can pretty well deal for many months to come.
Now, in addition to Alabama, well, let's first start there. What's its competing use for this water?
Well, at the root of this, I'm sure, is who gets to grow the most in the future and who will have enough water to grow in the future. The immediate needs that Alabama has are things like a nuclear power plant, pulp and paper mills, small downstream communities, plenty of industry. Those are the things in Alabama. In Florida, there's a very rich oyster bed in the Apalachicola River. That's downstream from us. It supplies most of the oysters that Florida harvests. In addition, they have a power plant on the river and other development downstream.
So, in other words, then, the governor of Georgia is saying, let us keep more of the water, and the governors or the ruling powers in Florida and Alabama are saying, no, don't do that. Let us get what we normally do.
Absolutely.
How long has this been going on?
Well, we've been in what we call a water war, a non-shooting water war, for something like nearly 20 years, probably. It's been in the court system. It's been in negotiations, mediation. We're still working on it.
And it is exacerbated, obviously, by this drought. You said the water levels were at historic lows in the reservoirs and that the streams were drying up as well. Has that happened in the past, or is that just this time around?
Well, they say that we're heading for historic lows in the lake. They're not quite there yet, but we've been in very dry weather, and part of the problem here is that we're expecting a very dry winter. That's usually when the lake would refill, and so they don't see a solution in the near future as far as the weather. We have been at low levels before in the lake, but our population has grown, and perhaps more important to the immediate issue, if you listen to the state of Georgia, is that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which operates that big lake that we've talked about here, is releasing much more water, has released much more water than it used to, and that is to meet what it says are downstream needs, specifically some endangered mussels in Florida and a power plant in Florida.
Okay. Now, you mentioned development and growth. How important is that as an issue in these southern states?
Well, for Metro Atlanta, we've long been one of the fastest-growing metro areas in the nation. We have now in excess of 4 million people in the metro area. We have probably a national reputation as being a fast grower. I think some people here want to see that continue to grow. Obviously, I would assume that the neighboring states want to get some of that growth as well.
Matt Kempner, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
Staff writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. So, as we see the very fast-moving disaster in California, there is also a slow-moving one going on in the southeast. And if the weather is dry, as is anticipated once again this year, we may be in for some serious trouble there. There also is, once again, in other parts of the country, very dry conditions. Minnesota, for example, in the Atlantic states, and the Northeast as well. Peter Glick is co-founder and president of the Pacific Institute. That's a nonprofit that provides research and policy analysis on issues of development and environment and security as well. And Peter Glick, good to have you on our program.
Good morning, Warren. Nice to be here.
Is this global warming?
Well, what we're seeing here is the combination of climate and nature and human development and growth and the water management policies we've put in place over the last century, really. We have droughts periodically in various places at various times anyway, so it's no surprise that any particular part of the country might be in drought at any given time. But what we increasingly have to worry about is not just natural droughts, but the fact that we are increasingly beginning to worsen those droughts because of climate change. Climate change is real. It's happening. The country is going to get hotter, and it's going to get drier in certain places. And so whether or not this drought was caused by climate change, we don't really know. But I think we could say pretty pretty definitively that it's being worsened by climate change and that these sorts of things are going to get worse in the future.
Is there a distinction to be made between climate change and global warming? These terms seem to be used interchangeably, but do they really mean different things?
No, they really mean the same thing. When I say climate change or global warming or the greenhouse effect, we're really talking about humans affecting the global climate. We talk about global warming because one of the major effects is going to be higher temperatures, and we're already seeing those. But higher temperatures isn't the only thing we're going to see. We're going to see rising sea level. We're going to see changes in rainfall patterns. We're going to see changes in the intensity and frequency of droughts and floods. There are a whole series of climatic things that are going to happen that we basically all call global climate change.
How can you have drought and flooding changing at the same time? Are patterns changing? Does that mean different things are happening in different places?
That's right. We see different things happening at different times in different places. So, for example, in California, we're going to see higher temperatures. We're already seeing higher temperatures. One of the things that's going to mean is less snowfall and snowmelt in the mountains, in the Sierra, which, of course, is the source of much of our water supply. So we could see faster runoff and higher runoff in the winter because it doesn't fall as snow, it falls as rain and runs off right away. And then in the summer months, we could have less water available. So we could have floods in the winter and drier seasons in the summer, which is sort of the worst of all things for us here.
Peter Glick, once again, co-founder, president of the Pacific Institute, talking to us from the San Francisco Bay area. John Gertner is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, wrote an article just this past week called The Perfect Drought. He joins us from New Jersey. John Gertner, good to have you with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Talk a little bit more, if you will, about what Peter Glick introduced as one of the problems here, and Matt Kempner for that matter, and that is growth and development and how they contribute to what's going on.
Hopefully I can be as eloquent as Peter was. I guess with the question of climate change, especially in the Southwest, how bad could it make things? And it could make things pretty bad because of the snowmelt decreases in the mountains. But what's also a problem is that population-wise in the Southwest, for instance, those states, along with Georgia, for instance, are the fastest growing in the country. I think the recent predictions for California is that it's going to have 60 million people. I think it has around 36 million now. By about 2050, it'll grow to those.
Three cities the size of Chicago to come in Los Angeles is one of the predictions that we hear. Go ahead.
Indeed. Colorado, where I spent a lot of time for my story, is supposed to go from 5 million to 8 million. Development in itself is an issue, but it's also a problem that we're not building more homes or buildings that use far less water. So there's the economic development piece of the issue. Then there's legal and political aspects of the problem, too. So if we look at climate change, for instance, and economic growth as two of these ingredients in this sort of stew of problems, for instance, on the Colorado River, which these seven states in the Southwest share, there's an extraordinary legal infrastructure that governs its usage called the Law of the River. And those laws create a lot of order when there is enough water in the river. But if we look ahead, for instance, at the climate projections, it appears that the river flow will go down probably significantly, perhaps very, very dramatically. So if there's not enough water in the river, things could get very complicated legally and very conflictual very quickly, probably something like in the Southeast that's happening now with governors fighting governors, states fighting states, and everybody in the river basin in litigation with each other.
I don't know the history in the Southeast, but I do know that in California in the Colorado River watershed, that the laws you're talking about are really pretty antique, are they not? These were agreements worked out long, long ago before there was anything like the population or even the anticipated population we have now.
That's right. A lot of them date back to the 1920s when a group of men sat in a room in Santa Fe and signed the Colorado River Compact. And some states got more water than others. Some of the upper states and lower states, I won't tire your listeners with all the minutiae of that legal agreement because lawyers are still sort of discussing what it means. But a state, for instance, like Nevada, which is a very dry state, the most arid in the nation, gets a smaller share of river water than any of the other states. It gets what's called 300,000 acre feet. So we can look at, say, a possible Las Vegas crisis in terms of the fact that the city's exploding, but we can also look at the fact that it has the historical misfortune, for instance, dating back some 85 years that when the river was divvied up, it got a smaller share than the other states.
John Gertner again with the New York Times Magazine. Back to Peter Glick at the Pacific Institute. How can we compare today's climate with what we know about the 1920s? And is that a useful benchmark to talk about climate change, to compare those times?
Well, we could certainly make comparisons like that. We know that it's hotter. We know that the average temperature and regional temperatures are going up, and we know that they're going up faster now than, unfortunately, even some of the pessimistic climate modelers projected. But there's another interesting factor that's at play here, and that is even without climate change, the kinds of stresses that John was just talking about on the Colorado River may be growing faster than we anticipated, because it turns out we may have given away more water on the Colorado River than nature naturally provides for us, because the river was divvied up in the 1920s based on a fairly short period of record that turns out now to have been relatively wet. So we may have given away more water even without climate change than the river can reliably provide to us. Interestingly, what's going on with Georgia and Alabama and Florida right now is in some ways an echo of that. We have a combination of having given away too much water in the river and yet having large population growth and, frankly, inadequate efforts to use water efficiently there.
We heard, of course, that Atlanta is one of the fastest growing cities in the country. John Gertner, back to you. Phoenix, I believe, is now the third or fourth largest city in the United States. At what point is there going to be serious trouble for Phoenix if we continue to go in the direction we're going?
Most of my story focused a little bit farther up on Las Vegas Colorado. That's okay. I asked the question of when does this become a problem. It's in terms of when these states, so to speak, run out of water, I don't think that's the question so much as when do they have to start making some difficult decisions. Agricultural transfers to cities is a sort of probably the biggest issue right now in the Southwest, how much water to take out of agriculture and how much water there is in agriculture, for instance, how much available water there is to bring over to the cities. But perhaps someone like Peter could speak better to Phoenix's future than I could.
We're almost out of time for this segment. Peter Glick, quickly, if you will, what about Phoenix?
Well, the reality is that there is no city in the country, certainly in the West, and I would throw Atlanta into there, that has figured out how to use its water as efficiently as it could. Las Vegas, Phoenix, Los Angeles, San Francisco, I mean, you name it, we could do what we want with less water. We could reduce the pressure on our limited water resources by figuring out how to use it more efficiently, by figuring out how to integrate efficient use with growth policies. And I think now these kinds of crises, the crisis that Atlanta and Florida and Alabama are in, the crisis that's growing on the Colorado River, had better push us in that direction. We can no longer afford to be as inefficient as we are.
Okay, that's exactly what we're going to talk about in a moment, design and development and its role in the ongoing crises that we're talking about. On Reporter's Notebook later, we'll hear about the Red Sox and the Rockies as this year's World Series gets underway. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. We're looking at water shortages in very fast-growing places in the United States at the same time that we seem to be undergoing a climate change that is going to cause serious problems. One of the ways of dealing with it, we have been hearing, is to change the way we build and develop. Frank Harmon is an architect in North Carolina. He's known for what's called a regionalist approach to design and planning. And Frank Harmon, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
North Carolina, also a part of the whole Southeast water crisis at the moment, I gather. Things are pretty dry there. Is that right?
Yes, we've had the worst drought in 100 years. We're in the middle of it right now.
Well, what about it? If this is going to get worse, what can we do?
Well, on a larger scale, I think it's inevitable that we have to consider how we're developing the land. It's a fact that we're probably building in places that we should not be building in. We're covering over farmland and some of the best agricultural land in North America with subdivisions that are far looser and more sprawling than they need to be. I think that's the question everyone is reluctant to answer, but that's probably where we have to start. On a smaller scale, I think that every building and every house is capable of collecting the rainwater that falls on it. And in an average-sized project, that rainwater is actually sufficient to serve that dwelling or commercial building or school for fully 1 year if it can be collected. So that's another approach, which is to avoid having the rainwater that falls on a site or a building run away, but actually capture it on site. And this would, of course, greatly reduce the need for water from reservoirs.
Would that be true even in Southern California and Arizona and Nevada?
I think it's much less true there because their rainfall is less. I'm speaking of the Southeast, where our rain typically is in the 40 to 50 inches per annum.
So go ahead. I think we're going to make other points. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No. I think this whole question of are we building where we should be building or not also applies to the Southwest and places where there is a traditional lack of water. The pattern is to build first and ask where the water is going to come from later. And one of the consequences of the drought that we're seeing here and probably the fires that we're seeing in California has to do with that.
So we're in the wrong places. What does that imply, that we should get out of them? Should we try to get people to leave San Diego and Phoenix and Las Vegas and Atlanta, for that matter?
Well, of course, that's a very difficult question. As you can see, it's a huge cultural and social question about where do we build and why. California is simply a wonderful place to live, and it has a great economy. But there are many places living in California is literally living on the edge of catastrophe, both earthquakes and fires. You know, left on its own, California would naturally burn every year. That was the pattern before we settled California. It's only since we've settled California and started to grow more trees and bushes and control fires that fires like we're seeing now became a huge problem.
And, of course, as I think people are learning now around the country, some of the vegetation that is natural here depends on fire and doesn't release its seeds until it burns. So it's just waiting there for the fires to come.
Correct. The great redwoods themselves require fire in order for the cones to open up and allow their seeds to germinate.
So, as you said, this lists suggests a lot of very difficult questions. What are those questions? What should we be considering?
Well, on the one hand, it is very hard, obviously, to make people leave where they already are, but I think we have to ask much tougher questions that can actually lead to very decent solutions about development in the future. That's on the development or the large scale. I think on the smaller scale, that when we build, we need to consider building and living more closely together and making buildings that are themselves conservative of water, in the way that it's used, and also how the building can collect water, and at the same time make buildings that are more resistant to fire. We recently designed a building in the Bahamas where we capture all the rainwater for the use of the occupants of that building on the roof, and they use that rainwater year long. They actually have to do that in the Bahamas because there's no fresh water available in terms of wells or streams or lakes. So they've been living like that for hundreds of years.
Frank Harmon, once again, architect in North Carolina, known for a regionalist approach to design and planning. We're beginning to figure out what that means. Steve Doyle is past president of the California Building Industry Association. Currently, he's president of Brookfield Homes. That's a home builder based in Del Mar, California, not far from San Diego. Steve Doyle, A, welcome, and B, I understand you've had to evacuate your house. Is that right?
That's correct. Yesterday at about 2 o'clock, we were allowed to go back to our home. Monday afternoon, about 2 o'clock, we were ordered to evacuate because of the fires.
Are you and many others in California living in the wrong place?
I don't think so. It really comes down to a management of our land resource. When the people of the United States have a right to move and live wherever they want, we have to provide them with as safe a house and as safe a community as we can. And that's really, you know, from a builder's perspective, what's going on. We don't tell people where to live, and we don't build houses where they don't want to live.
Well, on the other hand, you don't build houses on the sides of cliffs and various other places, even though you might be able to do that. Doesn't there have to be some kind of consensus as to where people ought to be able to live, and particularly ought to be able to live in large numbers, depending on the availability of resources such as water?
True. And if you look at what California's done over the last 17 years with water, with energy, with the location of development, with the planning of development, you'd be rather amazed at how much progress we've made. We now use approximately 30% less energy in a new home in 2007 as compared to a new home in 2090. We now use 50% less water in a new home in 2007 than we do in a new home in 2090. Now, the problem we have, the biggest issue we have in California, is that new homes only add about 1% to the total housing stock on an annual basis. So we have a lot of homes that are built pre these new standards and pre these new guidelines for design.
Why is it, though, that the fires and the disasters resulting from the fires seem to be getting worse and worse? Records are being set. 2003 in Southern California was a terrible one. Now this one appears to be even more extensive.
Well, having lived through both, I can tell you that the majority of the damage has been done in areas where older communities developed, not in areas where newer communities developed. And as Frank mentioned, it is true that the habitat, the natural growth and vegetation that we have, is not only subject to regular burning, it needs regular burning to revive itself. We have had issues in the past where we have tried to control those burns to the point that we have gone 30, 40, 50 years without having that brush burn. Once it gets to that point then that it starts, it has a tremendous fuel load and it's very difficult to control. What we're working on now, both with planning of new communities and with existing communities, is how do we manage that wild land? How do we manage that natural growth so that it can be thinned on a regular basis, that the fuel load can be brought down, so that it still provides habitat without providing such a fire hazard?
Steve Doyle, again, past president of the California Building Industry Association. Let me go back to John Gertner, earlier guest on our program, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, wrote The Perfect Drought in last weekend's edition. So we're beginning to see what you predict are going to be the kinds of disputes that will occur as growth continues in places like Southern California and Atlanta and Arizona, with the argument being made that people ought to be able to live wherever they want to.
I think so. I don't think we've even begun to reckon with how difficult that question of how much should we develop or how can we limit economic growth. Those are extraordinarily complicated questions. When I was in Las Vegas, for instance, and speaking with the water manager there, Patricia Mulroy, I mean, I asked whether you know, you could limit growth if you're constrained with water, wouldn't that be a logical solution? And her reply was that she didn't even know if it was possible. And she made a pretty persuasive case. When cities are competing with cities, other cities, neighboring cities, for economic development and businesses, when states are competing with neighboring states for residents and to grow their economies, I think it becomes a very complicated question. And also the idea of whether you can manage regionally, which would probably make more sense than to manage growth individually by city, by county, for instance, or even by state. But it seems like we're a long way away from that.
Let me go back to Frank Harmon in North Carolina, our regionalist person when it comes to design and planning. What about regional management? When we see governors getting into arguments as they have, it would appear in many cases boundaries were really not drawn with resources in mind. Has there been any progress in the regional approach, or at the moment are we seeing people going head-to-head?
Well, for historic reasons, it's traditionally the most difficult cooperation to get on a regional level because municipalities and counties are organized by their boundaries. A much more rational way to think about it would actually to be organized regions by their watersheds. In North Carolina, for example, we have 7 major rivers, and it would make far more sense to manage the resources of those river watersheds than it would be to talk about sharing water from one to another.
Is anybody talking that way, or at the moment is this just pie in the sky?
I think we're going to start hearing a lot more talk about that, given the effects of the drought that we've had.
Let me go back to Steve Doyle with the Building Industry Association in California. What about that kind of change and that kind of planning? Would you and other builders, do you think, be amenable to that?
Not only amenable, but we're actually working with the state legislature to advance our regional planning system right now. I agree that when local jurisdictions, smaller cities, are battling it out for economic benefits, it's very difficult. But if you can mandate that type of regional planning at a what we call a COG, a central organization of governments, that in California we've established 11 of those. If you can mandate that kind of planning at that level, then you get past the discussion and the debate on a city-by-city basis as to where the next Walmart's supposed to go.
On the other hand, we have in California, as you well know, not just the legislature, but the cities, the counties, and the various special districts and all kinds of jurisdictions which want to guard their turf.
Exactly. We're dealing with that on an air resources level. We're dealing with that on a stormwater level. We're dealing with that on a transportation level. So our argument is, why can't we put all of these things together and get the regional planning in there as well?
John Gartner with the New York Times, again, you've studied this on a journalistic basis, been looking around at it. How are they doing in Sacramento and other places with this kind of regional approach? Are they just beginning it, or are they down the line?
Well, if I could actually speak to Nevada's issue there with
sure.
water, they did actually approach water issues in a more regional way by combining their water authority into something called the Southern Nevada Water Authority some years back, because they had exactly that. They had municipalities sort of competing with neighboring municipalities for water resources, and finally the realization that, hey, we are all in this together, and we're sharing a fairly scarce resource that appears to be scarcer and scarcer as we get more and more crowded here. If we combine things, not only will we be more efficient, but in terms of engineering, but in terms of just the human and social efficiency of working together. So it certainly can work, but again, there are big obstructions, political obstructions, legal obstructions, and those boundaries between cities and counties are they're pretty deep, and I think they're hard to erase.
Again, John Gertner with the New York Times Magazine. Steve Doyle with the Building Industry Association. Do you recognize any limits, or do you think we'll be able to continue to grow and build and find ways of coping despite the enormous increases in population that are predicted, particularly in the Southwest?
Well, there certainly are limits if we do not take into consideration all these issues we've been discussing. Some of the things regarding water that California has been working on for the past 15 years include things like desalination, using ocean water as potable water, water reuse and water management, both of our stormwater and of our sewage water, so that we are now watering our landscaping, irrigating our landscaping with non-potable water, groundwater recharge, collecting our stormwater and recharging our groundwater basins with it instead of letting it run simply out to the ocean. And then in addition, being more efficient with our water storage and our water transportation. The argument in California, especially in Northern California, is not do we have enough water, but do we have the water used the right way? Over 70% of the water that falls in the Sacramento and the San Joaquin basins goes out under the Golden Gate Bridge. We're not using the water to the most efficient way that we can.
Same thing happens in Los Angeles, which has very intense rainfalls from time to time, although not very often. But when it does, it really rains a lot, and there's really no mechanism, is there, to collect that water here. Could it be done?
It most certainly could be done, and we are beginning to do the engineering and the planning to allow for that. These large river basins that collect huge amounts of water in these very intense short-period storms that we get, are ideal locations for temporary storage so that we can then use that water to, as I said, recharge groundwater or use it for non-potable water needs such as irrigation once the rains have stopped.
Of course, people have been talking about that for a long time, and in Los Angeles there is invariably an opposition that pops up that says, you know, we're not going to have the toilet to the tap, as if they were going to reclaim water that was sewage and use it in the water supply. That's a big political issue and easy to simplify. And I wonder, Steve Doyle, if you think that there's going to be an awful lot of arguing before we, in fact, begin to do this on a very extensive basis.
Oh, I definitely agree, and I'm not sure we'll ever get to the point where the general public will accept a toilet-to-tap type of approach for water reuse. But we don't have to use that tap as the sink in your kitchen. That tap could be the fixture that's providing water to irrigate the soccer field or the median landscaping along your major roadways, thereby freeing up potable water, water that people are very comfortable drinking, to go to that tap in the kitchen.
John Gertner, quickly, a final question with the New York Times Magazine. You predicted earlier on, and I think it's pretty clear as we talk here, there are a lot of solutions and good ideas about how to better manage, but there's also a lot of politics and a lot of existing law.
That's right, and I think maybe just one last point to make is that you know, sometimes a crisis can be a good thing, certainly not a firestorm, but certainly a kind of water crisis or the like, where it actually forces people to confront some difficult problems that may only grow worse in the coming years and take a hard look at them and say, how can we adapt, how can we adjust, how can we act quickly, how can we make good choices rather than fight, and actually sort of pursue some solutions.
So for our listeners around the country, then, what you're seeing in Southern California may in some way be a kind of a laboratory experiment, an exaggerated look at what might be coming to your neighborhood sometime soon. Thank you all for being with us. John Gertner with the New York Times Magazine, Steve Doyle with the California Building Industry Association and Brookfield Homes in Del Mar, California. Good luck with your house. Thanks to Frank Harmon in North Carolina, our regionalist when it comes to design and planning, Peter Glick, our earlier guest with the Pacific Institute, and Matt Kempner, also with us from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Colorado Rockies won 21 of their last 22 games this year, a streak that made baseball history. They've now had to wait 8 days for tonight's World Series opener against the Boston Red Sox, who were behind Cleveland 3-1 before winning the American League Championship. We'll hear more about that in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Warren Olney back with Purporter's Notebook on To the Point. The Red Sox were lovable losers for decades before they won the World Series in 2004. The Rockies had never won anything till they became this year's miracle team. John Thorne is editor of Total Baseball, the encyclopedia of Major League Baseball, now in its 8th edition. Talk to you every year. It's good to hear from you again.
My pleasure to be with you.
What about this miracle team and the Christian association with the Rockies, all the way from management, apparently, down to many of the players with the scriptures on the wall in the locker room and executives praying together and players being fired for consorting with prostitutes, which other teams might wink at?
Well, I would like to say first that some of my best friends are Christians. And second, that what people think or believe or say is not as important in a baseball context as what they do. In other words, in the clubhouse, are their values being foisted upon non-believers or people who have alternative persuasions? It seems to me that O'Dowd, the general manager of the Rockies, has gone some distance toward separating himself from the perception that was raised in that USA Today column a year ago that no Jews need apply, no Catholic Hispanics need apply.
So there are then people of different faiths on the Rockies teams, and they're acceptable like everybody else?
Well, O'Dowd, we think he is not using code language when he says that even at the farm level, he is recruiting players of high character. Now, if high character means Christian, and if high character means born again, then we have troubles. But frankly, as an American, any ball player is entitled to think what he wishes and believe what he wishes privately, and he can consort with those of similar persuasion. There are always interest groups and factions on teams. And the factions are not necessarily hate the manager or love the manager. They may be simply guys who like to hang out together, those who like country and western versus those who like rap. This is natural. In a group of 25 men, there will be differences.
Is there any evidence that by having men of good character on the team, they performed this extraordinary feat of winning 21 of their last 22 games?
Well, no one was talking of character in the other years that they did not reach the playoffs. This was a truly wretched team with a player procurement policy which was idiotic, and O'Dowd has much to answer for there, of getting all of these limited-range sluggers who could hit 360-foot fly balls that became 400-foot fly balls in the Colorado air. They always played better at home than on the road by a preposterous margin. This is similar to the Red Sox procurement policies in the bad old days when they were just looking for guys who could hit those fly balls over the wall.
Shorter wall in Fenway Park.
Yes, the 315-foot wall, which it turns out is 308 or so.
Right. Well, what about the Red Sox? Everybody loved them when they were losing.
Yes, I think, Nathaniel Hawthorne is turning over in his grave that he no longer has a baseball team to support. There are no more gothic values. Yes, the Red Sox were more lovable as losers, and now they've been displaced by the Cubs. And when the White Sox won the World Series, we thought the Cubs had to be next. Then the Giants after that, and perhaps the Indians too. Let all the losers have their fiestas. That's why I'm rooting for the Rockies.
You are? Because they haven't won before?
Because they are the designated underdog. They remind me of the 69 Mets going against the Orioles, a team that should be happy just to be there. But they can make a lot of mischief.
Okay. What's the key, then, to their 21 out of 22, and how are they going to keep it going after 8 days of rest?
Well, the law of the universe, of course, is inertia, that when things are going well, they tend to keep going well. And when they're going badly, they tend to keep going badly. So they are just caught up in something that they don't really understand and is larger than themselves, and can it last for another 4 games?
Doesn't appear the deity has anything to do with it?
Well, I think you may have to ask those in the Rockies clubhouse about all questions related to deities.
Rudy Giuliani's rooting for the Red Sox. He coming from New York. Is this the kind of series that divides people up in odd ways when you have a team as full of tradition and as storied as the Red Sox against a team that's never won anything?
It creates odd divisions because, the position formerly occupied by the Red Sox is now occupied by the Rockies. And it's interesting to me that we can now have variety create headlines like Sox beat Rocks on Fox.
Spoken like the editor of Total Baseball, the encyclopedia of Major League Baseball. You're always looking for those things to make things look new and different. So you say you're rooting for the Rockies.
Because they are the unexpected team. They're not only a wild card team. When the Red Sox won the World Series in 2004, they also were a wild card entrant.
So what if you were a betting man?
If I were a betting man, I would have to go with the Red Sox because they have superior starting pitching and they've got all-stars at several positions, and it's very tough to argue against the middle of that lineup.
You going to go to any of the games?
No. At my age, I prefer a big chair and a beer at my side rather than having beer thrown on me at Fenway Park.
How much does the Red Sox Nation that travels from game to game, packs up the stadiums, and angers a lot of fans in other places, how much do they have to do with the success of the Red Sox? And are they going to be able to go all the way to Colorado?
I think that they're emulating the Royal Rooters that led the Red Sox to the World Series championships in 1903 and 1912, 15, 16, 18, 5 in a row. They are obnoxious. They're noisy. And they're rabid, and they're passionate, and everyone in Boston loves them, I think. But those who are not of the same persuasion hate them.
Do they help, do you think? Do the players really pay any attention to that, or are they so focused on the game that they're not really aware of that kind of presence around them?
It's a giant fetish. I think the players don't really care, but The illusion for those who are part of Red Sox Nation and visibly part of it is that without them, victory would be impossible.
Rockies sold their tickets to the World Series online, didn't give the fans in Colorado a chance to go to the stadium and line up?
They just don't know how to do this. You know, they're coming to the costume ball dressed in a party gown.
Okay. And you hope that it's going to be a party for them.
I hope so. I think it'd be a great story. And for the Red Sox to lose in the series, well, they won in 2004. Let's make them a little more lovable again.
Okay. John Thorne, as always, good to have you with us. We'll talk to you as the week goes on.
Terrific.
Editor of Total Baseball, the encyclopedia of Major League Baseball. Once again, it is in its eighth edition. Today's program produced by Francis Anderton with Katie Cooper and Dan Konecki. Our technical director is Mike Newport. For more information about To The Point or to email us, visit kcrw.com/To The Point. We'll always be glad to hear from you. I'm Orman Alney. Join us again for To The Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.